Welcome to Cybersecurity, Combating Threats to Our Software Environment, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today's panel will discuss the new wave of cyber attacks, today's weakest links, proactive approaches to defend and save costs, and recommendations to address software vulnerabilities most effectively and stay ahead of the continued cyber threats. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
Welcome to the show. Our guests today are Bob Lentz, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber, now in consulting. Rob Carey is the Deputy CIO of the Defense Department. And retired Rear Admiral Betsy Height, now Vice President of HP Enterprise Services for the U.S. public sector. Our theme today is cybersecurity and combating threats to the software environment. And we're going to be talking about software security assurance, ensuring resiliency and delivery of capabilities to the national defense environment, and also the government and industry as a whole. So let's get right to it. 2011 seems to be shaping up as the year of chaos. We've had Stuxnet, actually late last year. We've had the NASDAQ attacks. We've had energy companies attacked. More recently, we've had Lulz Security hitting the Senate, and we've had the RSA attacks. I mean, it's really been something for everything. So has this spate of attacks and the publicity altered the debate or moved it along? Rob, why don't we start with you?
I think it's I don't know if it's altered the debate, but maybe shown a light on it that hadn't been seen in the last couple of years, in that the attacks can go to the internet as fast as anything else can now. It's literally moments. We've seen reports of events on the blogosphere then showing up within minutes on the front page of major publications. So I think there's a visibility brought to the number and the severity of the challenges, which then brings the debate about, because now it's on the internet, it's going to get discussed, it's going to be brought about, the customers of the folks who have been attacked start to get antsy and questions, and so I think it has brought a heightened awareness to the issue that has been around for some time.
And Ms. Height, it seems like from the services perspective, everybody is now realizing the potential we've talked about so much. What are you seeing from your point of view?
I think the real difference is scale. It used to be we would have an individual have their identity stolen, or it could be that an organization that was not particularly well known or did not touch a person's life directly had something happen to them. But now, with between the threat of nuclear reactors overseas being impacted, the threat of your son's bank account because he happens to be part of the Sony Entertainment Consortium, the threat of all kinds of things happening that really impact people directly has made a huge difference.
All right, and Bob Lentz, what from your point of view, has the debate heated up? Has it gotten more urgent?
Yeah, I think as Rob and Betsy said, I think the debate has become much, much more intense than we've ever seen before. I think it's because of the fact that it's no longer just a few targeted areas. It's across every infrastructure being impacted. It's not just limited to the military, and it's international in scope as well. And so I think the pace, the sophistication of these attacks, I think, is making everybody wake up to the fact that this is really the tipping point for this whole arena.
All right, so we have a lot of debate and we have a lot of publicity. What about the defensive posture itself? Do you find that companies and federal agencies are getting a little bit more on the ball now because the defense requirement, a defense that is not Defense Department, but the cyber defense requirement has become so much more apparent? Are we moving faster, Rob Carey?
I think we're moving in a more informed manner. I don't know if faster is the right word. I think we understand companies and agencies 5 years ago who maybe thought about information security as a place to put money now understand the severity of investing in the protection of their information. And so I think it is more about that awareness. I think senior leaders at the highest levels now have this in their lexicon. 5 years ago, they didn't have this in their lexicon. So this is now a cohesive part of most organizations' strategies, whereas a few years ago, it was a bolt-on after the fact, can I afford it strategy. So I think we're moving into the right place, but I also believe that the defense is very complicated and has to be integrated into the mission of that department in such a way that the balance of the investments are made properly.
But is it safe to say that having that top-level awareness suddenly when enterprises are at stake, that's really a help to the people that have to get the job done?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the top cover that your boss at the highest levels understands what this is, and as you rattled off at the beginning, the number of events that have occurred just recently, those companies understand that the role that they play in securing their information is really important.
And Betsy Height at HP, your customers define that there's a higher level of interest in the kinds of services that cyber companies are providing thanks to the increased intensity of this debate and publicity we've had.
Well, I think all customers, both commercial and government, realize that the defense of these networks is a very complex problem. And you cannot simply believe that if you protect your perimeter, everything inside your perimeter, meaning the most important things, the data, the information, the analysis, is safe. And so what I'm seeing in terms of both commercial and government clients is that there is a realization that there's a place for network security, there's a place for information security, there's a place for software assurance, and all of these things have to be combined in order to protect those crown jewels, the information or intellectual property of the organization.
And Bob Lentz, anything to add on that? We wanted to ask about that whole idea of the high-level involvement. Is that moving people more urgently toward that cyber posture that we need?
Yeah, I think cyber has clearly entered the boardroom, and I think it is at the top of the agenda. And as a result, as we just talked about, it is resulting in a reprioritization of resources to be able to deal with this problem up and down the ISO stack. It's not just limited to one area. And I think one of the reasons why this panel is so important is we've had a tendency to focus a little bit too much over the last 5 years on the network layer. I think we have to get back to the basics, which is at the software layer as well, and do this in a balanced fashion.
And we're going to get to all those details about software security and how you secure that. But I wanted to just kind of work on the environment a little bit now. There's been an article recently by Richard Clark, well-known cyber consultant, former White House guy, and he talked about China, and you hear about Russia and various countries without getting into some kind of a Cold War here. But this seems to have been internationalized. And what does that do, if anything, to the way we secure networks?
I think from our perspective, the threat to our, as Betsy said, the information on our networks is very real, very persistent. We understand it to the extent that we're defending against it. We understand our perimeters. We understand defense in depth is a very necessary component here. And as Bob said, it's now hit the E-ring of the Pentagon as well, so that wherever the threat comes from, I mean, we're not concerned about that. Some are more sophisticated than others. We talk about it in a sophistication gradient. As Betsy alluded to, we started out with kids and stealing identities and script kiddies, and you work your way up to crime and terrorist groups, and then you hit the nation states. And so we have to defend against that whole spectrum of threats, and that's exactly how we position our investment strategy to deal with the threats that pose the most potential harm to us in the execution of our mission.
And so far as you can tell, what do the cyber thieves, hackers, phishers want from Defense Department?
There's a category XYZ, you name it, they're after it. They're also after weak links, and they like to use spear phishing as a way to get inside of our heads, because that is the weak link, is where the human is. Where the machine interfaces are and where the code is generally does what it's intended to do. The challenge is that keeping our workforce and our leadership from doing things on the internet that they can't recover from, because they would never see this threat. It is hidden to them.
Okay, and if the Pentagon had an F ring, you might say that would be the defense industrial base. All the people that support the Pentagon, to continue with that analogy, And so Ms. Height, is looking across the spectrum of DOD and industry from your point of view, are they after pretty much the same things? I mean, what is it that industry most worries about from cyber?
With respect to cyber attacks on the defense industrial base, I think there's a real recognition amongst sophisticated attackers that the Department of Defense in the United States relies heavily on its manufacturing and political partners. And so there was a day when the Department of Defense was really in the software development manufacturing role. That is not true today. So if, in fact, an adversary can get into a system, an IT system or a weapon system, either during its production or in transit to the department, wouldn't that be a really wonderful shortcut to get to the information that the department is so desperately trying to protect in order to ensure the security of the nation? So between the idea of a global environment of manufacturers, a global team of software developers, a global information highway that is used to conduct all operations. There are lots of avenues to get at critical DOD information, and each of those avenues of attack needs to be thoroughly considered.
And Bob Lentz, how important is it that we know the origins? Because, you know, we can do traces pretty well and say, well, this came from China or that one came from Canada, or sometimes they originate in the United States. Is that really important to do all that back tracing to find out what the origins are?
Well, I think attribution has always been our toughest challenge in cyberspace. It still continues to be our toughest problem. And it is clearly a priority. But at the same time, I don't think we want to get hung up on the attribution issue, because that's part of what I would classify as the cyber warfare dimension of cybersecurity. What we're talking about right now is the cybersecurity foundational elements that are very, very critical throughout the supply chain, throughout the implementation and operationalizing of all these capabilities. And attribution is just one very important aspect, but I think right now there are many other very important things we have to focus on.
Okay. And Rob Carey, I mean, the Defense Department is a software-controlled entity. Pretty much nothing happens without software in DOD. And so some of the source code is very old, but nevertheless, it's accessible by some means, and a lot of coding goes on today. So give us an idea of the extent to which source code is vulnerable and whether people are adequately aware of that vulnerability. I guess I'm sort of leading you there, but tell us your thoughts on that.
I don't think we have enough time, Tom, but to hit it all. But code is inherently built securely or not from its genesis, and I think Bob and Betsy would agree with me that it starts with teaching these kids how to code securely, and then you build in a defense in depth and a defense in breadth as the system manifests itself and it's in its formative stages. But code itself can be written to be reasonably secure and manage the risks associated with it. I don't think there's any code that is 100% secure. It's not possible. But it is possible to do the right things to know when it's been touched or tampered with so that it stops doing it, or it lets the user know that, hey, something occurred. So while we own very old code and very new code, at least we have recognized that this is part of the basis of our investments to work on software assurance in addition to the hardware assurance and supply chain.
But you also have to protect the code itself from wholesale taking.
Yes, yes. And I think we do a pretty good job of that for the most part. For those systems that are sensitive operators for us, we go to great lengths to both physically and logically protect the code. But that's not to say that the code can't be broken into because of the extent of our networks. So we are such a large place to shore up the thousands of networks that we own and then the code that's contained in them. I mean, we're balancing that risk with managing two wars at the same time.
And Bob, what are some good ways to balance that approach when you have to protect the code itself as a piece of intellectual property, and you also have to make sure that code is developed securely when it's conceived Those are really two different problems. And what are state-of-the-art approaches to making sure that both bases are covered?
Well, I think one of the things that this question reminds me of is right after 9/11, the Secretary of Defense sent a team of us to Silicon Valley, and the question was, what new technologies and challenges do we want to give the innovators to be able to get on top of this issue of the information technology race that we were starting to get into? And one of the challenges we said is we need to do better automated forms of software security, and we need new tools to do that. And we gave that challenge to Silicon Valley back in about 2001, 2002. And what occurred was the birth of several new startups that came up with these new tools. And now these startups, just on the spirit of our entrepreneurial system, were then acquired by larger companies. HP happened to be one of the companies that acquired one of those. IBM acquired another. We now are in a position where we now have these automated capabilities to finally get on top of this problem. Not to say we weren't doing an okay job, but now we can leap ahead and really begin to do the things that Rob talked about earlier.
And Ms. Height, tell us, what is the number one thing that customers come to your services for, and what do they want?
They really want some assurance that the code, the software that they have purchased, will perform as it is expected to perform without being able to being subject to some malicious behavior. But I would say that we're on this journey. So, you know, back in the days of early code development, we were just trying to get the ones and zeros to spit out the right answer. Look at where we are today. Just as the threat has become more and more sophisticated, so have the tools to mitigate malicious behavior taking over and subsuming what the code should be doing. So whereas years ago we were in the midst of manual code analysis, we can do that in an automated way today. And just as Bob mentioned, when the challenge went out to Silicon Valley some 10 years ago, there was a huge effort to begin to understand the new threats, the complexity of codes. Used to have code that was tens or thousands of lines. Now it's millions and millions of lines. We cannot treat the current complex software code today the way we used to treat it in the past.
You're listening to Hewlett-Packard's Cybersecurity, Combating Threats to Our Software Environment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Your mission-critical IT information systems just got hacked, confidential data stolen. Could this have been prevented? Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective. And that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications that run your enterprise. Hackers, cyber criminals, and cyber terrorists are able to gain entry to vital assets through software because the vast majority of today's most critical applications have not been developed with software security vulnerabilities in mind. HP can help your government organization secure mission-critical applications that you depend on to run your agency's most vital operations by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. It's time for a new approach. Learn more about how HP can help you keep your critical applications and data secure. HP.com.
Welcome back to Hewlett-Packard's Cybersecurity, Combating Threats to Our Software Environment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Our guests today are retired Rear Admiral Betsy Height. She's now Vice President of HP Enterprise Services for U.S. Public Sector. Rob Carey, Deputy CIO of the Defense Department, and Bob Lentz, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber. He is now a consultant. And let's talk about the software environment at first, because software is not one thing, but there's off-the-shelf products that thousands of people use. There is fully custom software that operates everything from submarines to drones, and then there's a lot of middleware software that runs business systems that for the government might be starting out as commercial but gets modified for DOD or for civilian agencies. So it's hard to characterize it. So, Rob, if you could, give us an example, give us an idea of what the software breakdown is for DOD, rough terms. and what some of the state-of-the-art techniques you're thinking about for making sure that each of those classes of software is secure.
Well, there, you know, we have COTS, we have GOTS, we have combinations thereof, we have highly sophisticated command and control software. So I suffice to say, we have a great deal of flavors of software, of which some are categorized as mission critical, some are not. But I will tell you, of recent, what's really important is, and I think Betsy alluded to this before, code before was built and assembled and compiled and put into its environment to run with the intent of producing a result that was expected, if you will. And now, because of the cybersecurity threats that have been introduced of recent, we're now very mindful of the fact that data can be altered, that things, the results can be very different and very harmful if something else occurs. So there is a focused amount of energy in the DoD to ensure that software produces results that are expected, no more, no less. Same thing with hardware assurance. We're trying to reduce or make closer the upper and lower control limits, if you will, of the performance of the software. There are tools available now that weren't available 5 years ago to do that activity. But, you know, from nuclear command and control, I mean, that is the highest assurance software that we can have. There is also MWR software that runs your ability to get into a gym. It doesn't require a whole lot of attention on our part. So we're trying to place our energy and emphasis on those high assurance systems that we must, absolutely must have work so that we can do our mission for the country.
And Bob Lentz, what do your customers look for in terms of how to find the state of the art? I mean, I imagine a lot of people come to you and talk about what do we do?
Yeah, I think two of the most prevalent questions I get in this area is, one, what has changed? And it goes back to the first question you asked in the beginning about the threat. The threat is becoming so targeted that it's no longer going after your commodity software that you buy out of, you know, the home, I mean, one of your home-based stores. It's going after now your customized environments. And that runs the gamut from the Department of Defense to the financial sector and energy sector, et cetera. So that's scaring a lot of people. It's no longer just your commercial software that you get off the streets. And then number two, the second thing that people are very worried about is, well, what am I going to do about that? Do I have the tools that in a cost-effective fashion? And to your question, the answer is now we are ready to really get on top of this problem in a very cost-effective fashion. So I think in a good way, let's be positive. I think we're at a point now where we can begin to address this problem once and for all and combine that with all the other defense in-depth capabilities that Rob alluded to earlier.
So we can do it in an automated fashion now, right? As software gets developed or deployed, we don't have to manually check through millions of lines of code.
Exactly. But also the other thing is we have to also go back to the basics and start with our education programs and let them begin to use these tools as well, because once they are comfortable, because security isn't taught in our computer science departments. And so once they begin to use these tools, then we are really beginning to get on top of this problem.
Well, we're going to get to that, too. I guess that would be the meatware problem, but we're going to get to that later on. And Ms. Hyde, I wanted to ask you, too, how do service providers keep up with the technology to make sure you're a step ahead of all this? I mean, if you look at the history of DoD software, it was Jovial and Jupiter at one time, programming languages, and then it was COBOL and Fortran. Now it's, you name it, garden variety. And you mentioned some tools coming out of Silicon Valley. But you've got to be a step ahead of all of it if you're going to be relevant as a service provider. So how does that happen?
You have to have an architectural and a holistic view of the information that you are both trying to provide to your public and protect from those who are not authorized to access it. And so that involves, one, understanding your data, where your data should reside, who should have access to your data, whether or not the software programs that are manipulating your data are authorized as assured software systems. In addition to that, this is not an area where you can ever stop. You have got to understand the many threats there, you may have threats of simply insiders being authorized through procedures to access information they really don't have any need to know. You may have an architectural view that allows all of your information to be public-facing instead of just that information that you need to inform your clients. You may have procedures that simply allow anyone with a particular password that's normally not set to anything that's terribly distinctively difficult to remember, access to information on your network. So whether it's authentication, it's assurance of your software, it's a understanding where your data resides, you have got to have a holistic view of this problem.
And let's talk about application security, and especially web application security, because, Rob, of course, the government is on a transparency tear, and that's to a large degree true of the Defense Department as well as civilian agencies. And there's a wide range of web applications being deployed, mostly to service members, but their families and veterans, so it gets to be a pretty broad population. Tell us the approach that you're taking to web application security.
The main thing that we want to ensure that we've been working on for quite some time is the role of our identity in the accessing of this data through a web interface. So as we rolled out common access cards now 10 years ago using PKI certificates, and the mandate shortly after the rollout was to PKI-enable websites so that now I authenticate to the website. It knows it's me. It's a reasonably sophisticated authentication process so that now when I conduct a transaction with the web, it's trusted. There's a level of trust between the user and the path and the actual data. So that's still and remains an important feature of moving ahead is the identity management component. The dilemma is at times certain data is suitable for public use and consumption and may not require two- or three-factor authentication to get to it. Others do. So we do a lot of transactions on our classified networks using these kinds of tools. Why? Because that's the best place to store the data is in a different place. I don't have to have client-server interfaces. I can have more web-enabled interfaces. So I think that piece has advanced over the last few years, and we'll continue to advance it over the next couple of years because, again, the threat doesn't stop. As Betsy alluded to before, the threat continues to get more sophisticated, and we have to stay ahead of it.
And speaking of identity management, Bob Lentz, the NSTIC came out recently, the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, and it's really a visionary document. There's no real product or what they call the ecosystem around identities yet that actually exists. And so do you think, are you optimistic that that whole idea of getting past passwords and usernames, the single-factor authentication that doesn't seem to work very well, can actually come sooner rather than later?
Oh, yeah. I mean, clearly, as Rob points out, identity was one of the top three priorities that we put in place back in 1998. Actually, Secretary Hamery put that in place.
You and do launched, date yourself.
Yeah, it launched the Common Access Card program that we invoked as the largest at the time identity infrastructure in the world. But I think most experts, I think, have gotten on the identity train, and they realize that a lot of these spear phishing attacks and other things are the result of people going after identities. So I think from that standpoint, I'm more optimistic than I ever was, and I was glad the White House issued that policy. On the other hand, I'm less optimistic that we have a real rigorous policy structure in place to deal with this software problem. And so I'd like to see us turn the corner in that area just like we've done in the identity area, even though we still have a long way to go in the identity area. On a 1 to 10 scale, we're probably – DOD, we're probably at a 6 or a 7. And the rest of the U.S., especially the U.S. government, we're probably down at a 2 or a 3. But that policy will help.
Still people using the password.
Right.
Okay. And, of course, web applications and passwords, that's retail cybersecurity. Looking at it at the, I guess, not the great word, but wholesale level, I wanted to ask you, Admiral Haidt, about Stuxnet, which proved how deeply and how specifically cyber attacks really can go. And this is not the same as attacking, you know, a Microsoft Word macro, but really a specific process controller. And heck, parts of Hewlett-Packard other than yours make devices which could also be the target of that type of attack, and there's really no limit to where that could go. So what did we learn from Stuxnet as an industry, and as, especially in providing services to companies, and did you get a lot of phones ringing saying, what does this mean to us?
As more and more companies begin to realize that cybersecurity is not their core competency, and they go to other industry partners for managed security services, there will be an awareness. There has to be an awareness as to what risks those companies are willing to take. Because we, as Rob said earlier, we don't have a 100% guarantee on security in cyberspace. It just will not happen. Even in a closed system, quote unquote, you still have insiders. So we simply will not be able to guarantee a security free zone. Now, that doesn't mean that organizations should not understand where their crown jewels are and the risks that they are willing to put those crown jewels at in terms of their cybersecurity environment. It also does not mean you can protect everything. So if you don't have an opportunity where you actually understand what you have to protect and to what degree, you will not be successful. So what Stuxnet told us was everything is vulnerable. There are some incredibly sophisticated capabilities that can be unleashed in this commons called cyberspace that you will not be able to anticipate and you won't see coming. So part of your plan is to defend. Part of your plan is to mitigate, and part of your plan is to recover.
Okay, and Stuxnet also showed, I guess, to some degree, and some of these other occurrences have showed how closely intertwined government and industry really are. And so, Rob Carey, from the DoD point of view, dependent as you are on the supply base and vice versa, what are some of the approaches you're taking to making sure that the supply base and the government and the DoD are on the same page with respect to the technologies that you're using to make sure software is secure and systems are secure?
Well, we've embarked on an effort with the defense industrial base to share information regarding threats to them and to us, because virtually the threats are virtually the same to both of us. Our information behind their firewall, as Betsy works on things on behalf of Department of Defense, the question is whose intellectual property is it? It is theirs on our behalf. The end state, the product, the result is something we need for our mission. And so the sharing of this information in the Defense Industrial Base program has been very powerful at enhancing our ability to defend our network environment, our information environment. That's been the benefit. And as Betsy said, it is about risk management here. It's not about can I direct somebody to have certain tools on their network? The answer is no. Can I ensure that they're aware of the threats and the amount of them, the level of them, the intensity of them, and the style of them? You mentioned Stuxnet, and Stuxnet being a very sophisticated piece of malware that was sort of released into the wild. And so it was a wake-up call, I think, to a lot of folks about the extent of computing to manage their infrastructure, and that these kinds of things can, in fact, affect them in a very negative manner. And so it brought our attention back to, where is Son of Stuxnet? When does that pop out? And how do I manage, you would say, am I chasing signatures about what comes through my firewall, or am I moving into understanding behaviors and you know, things within an upper and lower control limit? And I think the latter is our focus now, because things like Stuxnet produce – effects that are undesirable, but you didn't see it necessarily coming in. You only see things changing on the outside.
And Betsy, I wanted to ask you too a follow up on that question. With the mutual dependency among partners, trading partners, and government and industry, in your business, do you ever get companies or agencies that say, you know what, we want to work with this other entity? And kind of do they come to you in pairs or in triples to say we have to work together, so maybe we need services provided in some kind of a uniform way?
As a matter of fact, HP has one of the largest global supply chains in the world in information technology equipment. And so we have a huge, huge number of partners. Because of that, we have significant and specific requirements that our partners have to comply with in order for HP to deliver the best product or service it can deliver, because that's the expectation of the client, and quite frankly, we wouldn't want it any other way. And so as we continue the journey of being a hardware company, a software company, and a services company, and understanding how all of those pieces fit together in a secure manner, it is incumbent not just on the capabilities that are owned by HP, but our partners as well, to deliver with the same level of commitment to quality as our clients demand.
You're listening to Hewlett-Packard's Cybersecurity, Combating Threats to Our Software Environment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Your mission-critical IT information systems just got hacked, confidential data stolen. Could this have been prevented? Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective. And that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications that run your enterprise. Hackers, cyber criminals, and cyber terrorists are able to gain entry to vital assets through software, because the vast majority of today's most critical applications have not been developed with software security vulnerabilities in mind. HP can help your government organization secure mission-critical applications that you depend on to run your agency's most vital operations by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. It's time for a new approach. Learn more about how HP can help you keep your critical applications and data secure. HP.com.
Welcome back to Hewlett-Packard's Cybersecurity, Combating Threats to Our Software Environment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Our guests today are Rob Carey, Deputy CIO of the Defense Department, retired Rear Admiral Betsy Height, now Vice President of HP Enterprise Services for U.S. Public Sector, and Bob Lentz, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber, now a consultant. And Bob, I wanted to have the first question go to you, and that is the idea of the fact that threats are unlimited, time and money are limited, and so the idea of taking a risk management approach is necessary to be able to get some kind of a cogent approach to the whole cyber problem. What's the best thinking nowadays and how you do that?
Yeah, I think two things have happened over the last 4 to 5 years in this era of cybersecurity. One of them is we really understand from a policy standpoint that we have to really focus on risk management. And you can't boil the ocean. And so we put out policy in DoD. It's been since fully implemented by NIST. And it really allows the leaders, the boardroom, as I said earlier, but more importantly in the Department of Defense, out of our buckshot Yankee problems of a couple years ago, the operators now will have their ability to get on their assets and begin to determine what's the highest priority, what's the medium priority, what's the lower priority. Rob talked about nuclear command and control, clearly high priority. The real bottom line to your question is we now really understand that it's all about risk management. We're moving to more online, real-time risk management with additional capabilities that are coming out, once again, from Silicon Valley. But we now really understand that in the case of software security, we need to prioritize the high-priority and medium-priority areas first, because that's where the bad guys are looking with these sophisticated capabilities.
And Rob, of course, I guess you could say that DoD is one big risk management agency, because you are dealing with all the risks to the United States that could possibly occur, including cyber. So how are you refining the risk management approach in the cyber area? What forms does that take?
Well, it's an investment strategy of where we place the emphasis, because as Tom said, there's not enough money to go around to solve both the kinetic issues that we have, our weapon systems, and as well as the non-kinetic communications issues that we have. So, as Tom said, as Bob said, we're moving ourselves towards this approach where we can categorize where we spend our money, how often do we spend it, and eliminating these low risk categories, because you have to go in and look at the risk associated with that information being compromised or a process or an outcome being compromised. I threw up the obvious softball of nuclear command and control. That's an obvious one, but the trade space in the middle gets very difficult. Where does one invest? And as Bob alluded to, the combatant commanders and the owners of these systems heretofore weren't necessarily worrying about this. They're worrying about their mission and their effects, but not, ooh, I have to protect the information of a system that only I own or I operate. How do I do that? And how do I get in on what somebody else is already doing? So the shared information space of how to protect the strategies, the tools, we are trying very hard to do that with a limited budget, and I think we're doing a decent job of it. But there is so much of what we have out there. You know, we're about half the federal government's IT spend in DOD. And so we're trying to leverage what other agencies have as well to make sure that our dollars are going as far as they can go.
And Betsy Height, at the operational level, many of your customers worry about specific things as the result of all this. And some of the specific things that occur might be, a SQL attack or an injection, or going after a buffer overflow, which is the result of all the risk management and all the decisions made. Those kinds of vulnerabilities are how they manifest themselves when it doesn't work out. And so what are some approaches to looking at it from the point of view of effect of that risk management to make sure that you look at it from bad outcomes and try to prevent it going upstream?
So 40 years ago, we had lots and lots of children die in automobile accidents. We don't have that today because we have child seats in cars. This is a journey. We have the ability to completely eliminate SQL injections from as an outcome from a malicious actor using today's technology. We have the capability. Many, many people simply are not aware of those technological advances. But just look at what the National Defense Authorization Act signed last January has required the Department of Defense to do. And that is Section 932 has required the department to implement software security assurance capabilities for both deployed software and that software that is being delivered. It simply is a matter of keeping up with technology and understanding when to apply that technology in the most important areas, especially those areas that are precious to you.
And Rob, was Section 932 a forcing function, or were you really on that course anyway?
No, we've been on the course. The fact that the Congress is now asking us to take steps that they've written down is actually okay. It's an accelerator. But as Betsy said, you know, this is about the basics. And because we're so big and we've built so many things, you know, the program manager down in the trenches had a problem, solved the problem by building a standoff solution that only he knew and understood, connects it to the internet. What protections does he have? Did he build in? Probably not a lot. Maybe not a lot. So could a SQL injection attack him? Yes, it could. So imagine an organization of our size having a lot of that, because in the 90s they could. We could build tools at our beck and call. Now as we get our arms around the problem, the basic blocking and tackling of cybersecurity, there's so much of it out there. We're plugging the holes as best we can, and that's why we're at the defense in depth approach. So the basics are only one piece. The sensors at the gateways, reducing the number of gateways, identity management, you name it. We have probably 20 different activities ongoing in addition to software assurance. That's sort of building out the layer that's around the code itself. Buildings and teaching kids in the academies to code securely. That's also, we're trying to hit this from almost every angle, because this is going to be a long process, as Betsy indicated. This didn't just happen the other day. This has been going on for 25 years, and it will continue to go on. So we'll have to continue to raise all boats slowly as we can.
And Bob Lentz, to continue that analogy of, people lost in car crashes, You can take the very specific way of doing that, like a SQL injection, and you could, say, wrap a child in bubble wrap for each trip. That's the micro approach. Or you could change the way cars are made and sold. That's the macro approach. That's the big risk management approach. Do you find that the military, the government, industry is wise in the approach of balancing the day-to-day versus the strategic?
Well, I think they clearly are beginning to understand how they have to balance this. I think, however, the best way that we're going to get on top of this problem is this, using the automobile example, because Betsy knows I love the automobile evolution, because that's exactly where we're going to be when it comes to cyberspace. An automobile back in the 1960s was only about 0.5% safety, and now it's up there 30% or more of safety. The IT budget is only about security, about 6 or 7%. The reality is we have to apply our resources more carefully. And so I think, just like in the automobile example, the industry pulled together when they dealt with airbags. Airbags used to cost a tremendous amount of money. They pulled together their technologies. They had enterprise capabilities. And now that's why you don't have one airbag in a car, but you literally have 10, 15 airbags in a car, because they have a common supply chain, they have enterprise capabilities, and we can do the same thing in software. We can have an enterprise capability, go across the entire Department of Defense, go not only to these high-level mission-critical applications, we can go to the medium, and in reality, someday, I really believe we're going to be able to go to the lower security areas. And that's where we need to go in this area.
Now, there's another element in this whole chain that we haven't talked about totally, and that is the people that work the systems, that handle the software, that have the authorizations. And there are really two classes of threat there. There is the insider that wants to do harm, and that's relatively rare for the most part. It occurs. But then there are the people to whom all of the recent phishing attacks have been directed. And years ago, we could see the Nigerian bank account email for what it was, and, you know, we laughed about it. Now, high-level people, financial people, are clicking on links that are in phishing attacks, so it's not funny anymore. What about education and training? How big an element is that in the whole chain of cybersecurity approaches? Rob?
Tom, it's huge. Spear phishing is probably the single softest underbelly to any organization because the human's in the loop. And even the most informed user will sometimes press a button, enter, click on a link with the mouse that they probably oughtn't to. Now, this is why we introduced PKI, why we sign and encrypt emails, because we have tried to reduce anonymity from the network. I know where I'm going. I know what came from me, maybe what came from Betsy, what came from Bob, and I have a reasonable risk-balanced approach at opening that email. So the continued education process of the basic user, as well as the guys who have the keys of the kingdom, the sysadmins, because it is amazing as you go and talk to those guys. It is about speed. It is about trying to go through your daily job as fast as you can, and we find out that sometimes these guys take shortcuts. They don't mean to, but they're trying to get things done. And so, in essence, they might sacrifice some things and leave some things, you know, that they wouldn't normally do, and there's a vulnerability produced there. So the education piece is huge. We recognize it starts in grammar school. You're teaching your kids to work on the internet. My kids all know how to do it. Now, do they know how to do it securely? The schools aren't teaching them that. Now, I certainly am trying. But it's something that has to be born from the day they start putting their fingers on the keyboard all the way until they're adults in their first, second, third jobs. And then you have a reasonably secure mindset as you approach this powerful tool called the internet.
And Betsy Height, is there any technological solution to that whole phishing and human interaction area, or is that just education?
Well, it's both. And Rob mentioned a wonderful technique of signing and encrypting an email. And so if you can do that and you are a savvy enough consumer to look at your email and realize you recognize who it came from. But, you know, you also have to be savvy enough to say, I'm going to delete that, and if they really need to get back to me, they will. You see that both in the digital world as well as the telephonic world. How many times have you gotten a call from somebody asking you about your credit card information, and they would just like for you to verify your authentication credentials over the phone to them? Oh, I don't think so. So, you know, we see this in all parts of our lives, and I think the one handicap that Rob and Bob and I all have is that we're digital immigrants. That might be good, it might not be. Our children and our grandchildren are digital natives, and so what comes natural to them may not come natural to us. But I agree, absolutely, it is a huge, education and awareness is a huge issue.
Well, there's a lot to think about, but we want to thank you for listening to Cybersecurity, the Untold Story, sponsored by HP and Fortify Software on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Our guests have been Bob Lentz, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Cyber, now in consulting, retired Rear Admiral Betsy Height, now Vice President of HP Enterprise Services for U.S. Public Sector, and Rob Carey, Deputy CIO of the Defense Department. And I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Cybersecurity, Combating Threats to Our Software Environment, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. If you missed any portion of the show, you can listen to the show in its entirety and on demand at federalnewsradio.com, keyword HP.
Your mission-critical IT information systems just got hacked, confidential data stolen. Could this have been prevented? Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective. And that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications that run your enterprise. Hackers, cyber criminals, and cyber terrorists are able to gain entry to vital assets through software because the vast majority of today's most critical applications have not been developed with software security vulnerabilities in mind. HP can help your government organization secure mission-critical applications that you depend on to run your agency's most vital operations by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. It's time for a new approach. Learn more about how HP can help you keep your critical applications and data secure. HP.com.